It is just past 7:08 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Starting our coverage this morning across the Atlantic, the United Kingdom is facing a hard deadline of March 29th for its exit from the European Union. But the political crisis is coming long before the deadline. What's happened is that the Conservative-led government of Theresa May has been trying to negotiate terms of exit in Brussels. And this is addressing everything from whether there are any kind of trade barriers or customs barriers between the United Kingdom and the rest of Europe, what the status is of the roughly 3 million European nationals who are not UK citizens but moved there under their open borders arrangement, and the border that runs between North Ireland and the Irish Republic, which has been a flashpoint for conflict for decades in the past. Right now, it's basically non-existent. Now, May tried to bring a package she had negotiated regarding the exit to the Parliament. This met a considerable amount of backlash, both from within her own Conservative Party and without. That prompted her to push the vote back to January 14th and prompted opposition Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn to try to bring to the floor a no-confidence vote, not in the government, but in Theresa May personally. Joining us to talk about the entire mess is Alex Dean. He's political correspondent with Prospect magazine in the UK. Joining us over Skype. Good morning. Good afternoon where you are,
hi,
I guess.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Why don't you walk us through the basics? What's in the deal that Theresa May negotiated and was hoping to bring to Parliament?
Sure. By far the most controversial aspect of this deal is the Northern Ireland backstop. This is an arrangement designed to prevent a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland in the absence of any kind of fancy trusted trader scheme, technological solution, or any combination of those things. The problem is that it would keep Northern Ireland and, to a certain extent, the UK as a whole, closely aligned with Brussels. Now, people who are strongly in favour of a hard Brexit, of course, don't want to see the UK closely aligned with Brussels at all. And it's quite a horrible prospect to them, and it terrifies them, really, the idea that we could stay shackled. So on the right of the Conservative Party, Brexiteers looking like they're not going to vote for the deal. Of course, the Labour Party, its job in opposition is pretty much to oppose, and it's going to vote down the deal almost certainly. It's not at all clear how Theresa May is going to get this deal through Parliament. And all the time, there's this prospect of no deal hanging over us, which is the legal default that we fall out on March 29th with no framework at all. You know, enter a legal vacuum, flights would be grounded, haulage of nuclear isotopes grind to a halt with delays at borders. And it could be very serious indeed. Hopefully MPs can get their act together and coalesce around an alternative. But the problem is they have to do so actively. If they do nothing, we will fall over the no-deal cliff edge.
Let's walk through the specific agendas of some of the factions that you mentioned. Let's start with the hard Brexiteers. Do they have a concrete proposal for what to do about the Irish border? I mean, for our American listeners' benefit, North Ireland is part of the UK. The Irish Republic is part of Europe. You can't have an open border between those two places without having an open border with Europe, can you?
I don't think you can. And the European Union, at least for now, doesn't think you can. And indeed, the UK government doesn't really think you can. But there is a very big discord indeed between the views of hard Brexiteers in Parliament. Jacob Rees-Mogg, not sure if he's a big figure in the US. He's an increasingly influential figure over here. Boris Johnson, of course, you will all have heard of. And they think that fancy technology, kind of cameras dotted around the border and so on, can create a situation such that Northern Ireland diverges from the Republic significantly without there needing to be imposed any hard border controls. Now, there is no precedent for that anywhere in the world. So as far as I'm concerned, this isn't a realistic alternative. And one of the things that people accuse Brexiteers of is precipitating, you know, the biggest constitutional rupture in British political history. We've been entangled with the European Union for 45 years now, and correspondingly, you know, are knitted into the legal fabric. They're trying to pull us out of that without a plan. At least that's the accusation levelled at them. Now, Theresa May's plan is full of holes, in my opinion. And I mean, I'd actually rather we had a closer relationship with Europe. I think that the economy depends on it. But for all her faults, Theresa May does at least have a plan. And I think that in this fraught political environment, we've come to a point where even having a plan at all is quite a positive thing, actually.
Her governing coalition, her Conservative Tory party does not have enough seats in Parliament on its own to govern. She relies on the votes of about 10 MPs from the Democratic Unionist Party in North Ireland. Where do they land
That's
on the
exactly
question
right.
of the Irish border?
So this quickly gets extremely complicated, but the basic principle is that the backstop for Northern Ireland, which the UK government has pretty much agreed, the EU is you know, totally in favour of, would, in order to keep the border open on the island of Ireland, would see a hard border of sorts imposed down the Irish Sea. So not across Northern Ireland as a landmass, but down between Northern Ireland and the mainland UK. And this is absolutely the reddest of red lines for the DUP, those coalition partners, who have categorically ruled out signing off on any deal which sees a hardening of regulatory divergence between Northern Ireland and the mainland UK, and sees an imposition of a border for regulation or customs and VAT, excise, all this technical stuff. So basically, the situation that we're in now, Theresa May is absolutely dependent on the DUP for support for her Brexit deal, and indeed to govern in general on kind of finance bills and the budget and anything you can think of. She needs their support. So she's run back to Brussels to try and get further assurances on this Irish backstop in the hope that she can, you know, pull something out of the bag at the last minute. The EU will blink and she'll be able to go back to the DUP and say that she has achieved significant concessions and they might swing in behind her. The hope is that when they do, enough of the Tory Brexiteers kind of in the uncertainty, huge pressure crushing down as the cliff edge approaches, the whips in the House of Commons will be, you know, really giving the most formidable operation in history to try and get all MPs to fall in line behind this deal. The hope is that they might just squeak it over the line, but it's far from assured. The problem is that there's no alternative in Parliament that seems to have a majority either. There doesn't seem to be an alternative that can command the support of the Commons at large. And anyone who says they know what's going to happen, I think, is having you on.
Well, the opposition party led by Jeremy Corbyn, they have not, the Labour Party, they have not been supporting the deal. Have they been specific about what they would like to see in it or what they would like to see as an alternative?
So Brexit puts the Tory party in an extremely difficult position because it cuts across their ideological fault lines in an unusual way, because the Conservative Party is pro-Brexit but pro-business, and Brexit seems like an anti-business move. It's just as awkward for the Labour Party but for different reasons. So they've been really hemmed into awkward positions, and it's very difficult to see how they can put forward clear proposals on it without isolating half of their core base. They've basically tried to stitch together support from young, you know, university-educated, metropolitan liberal voters in cities like London, Manchester and Bristol, with factory workers in Northern England who have kind of been Labour's base for decades now, and, you know, generations after generations of Labour voters who voted Leave. So the first half voted Remain, the second half voted Leave, and Labour needs to somehow keep them both on side. Now, that's incredibly difficult to do. And what we've seen is Labour kind of awkwardly triangulating over the past few months, trying to explain why it hates Theresa May's deal and why it's not going to vote for it, which actually it's not going to vote for because it wants to precipitate a crisis that brings about a general election. But it doesn't want to look like it's in this for just a party political gain. So at the moment, the biggest difference between actually the concrete proposals from the Labour Party and the concrete proposals from the Conservative Party is that the Conservative Party has signed up to a temporary customs union with the European Union, and Labour has signed up to a permanent customs union with the European Union. Now, that is clearly quite a negligible technical divide. And, I mean, if Labour got into government, I imagine that that pressure from their membership, which is overwhelmingly pro-European, would probably start to exert itself, and they might come in in favour of a softer relationship with Europe. But certainly their position is contorted. And one of the biggest problems in this whole swirling political crisis that's unfolding at the moment is that there's no leadership from either side. Every side is just trying to survive one day to the next.
Well, what about public opinion? Are there any signs it's shifted since UK voters actually voted in that referendum to leave the European Union?
So there have been shifts slightly towards Remain. And something that has to be pointed out is that because elderly voters were so much more likely to vote Leave and young voters were so much more likely to vote Remain, actually just from demographic shifts, if we were to hold another vote, even if everyone voted the same way they did last time, if they did vote, if you see what I mean, it would be it would swing just slightly to Remain. There hasn't been the concerted, significant shift to Remain of kind of 10 or 20% in the polls that Remainers would have liked to have seen. I think we may well end up getting a second referendum, not because of massive anti-Brexit sentiment growing in the country, but rather because there is simply no clear way forward, because it all traces back to that referendum in 2016, when the options on the ballot paper were Leave and Remain. We voted to Leave, but no one spelled out what Leave meant. There was no specific prospectus. And what we've seen since mid-2016, I think, is the grinding, crunching gears of the British political establishment desperately trying to provide an answer to that question of what Brexit means. It still doesn't know, and we've only got 3 or 4 months to go.
How accommodating has Europe been in the negotiations?
Now, that is a very good question. I think they've been as accommodating as you could have expected them to be, given that they have their own interests to protect. And it's tricky for them because they've got 27 member states. And, you know, it's an extraordinarily broad coalition. And once they've signed off something with those 27, such as the Northern Ireland backstop, it's very difficult indeed for them to, you know, make a last-ditch flexible manoeuvre to try and keep the UK on side. That said, they have made a few concessions. Originally, this Northern Ireland backstop was going to see a customs and regulatory border down the Irish Sea. And actually, we lobbied the EU for a UK-wide customs union sooner than the EU would have wanted to give it to us. So they would have always given us a customs union. It's not much of a concession, but they've given it slightly sooner than they initially said they were prepared to. And that softened the border down the Irish Sea, which means that the DUP are more likely to get on side with the government. But clearly there are basic power dynamics exerting themselves here, which is that the UK is essentially a high mid-tier power and the European Union is an economic superbloc of 27 other countries, you know, Germany, France, absolutely sticking hard to their position. And actually, I think, frankly, if you look at the concessions made by both sides from the beginning of this, Britain has made significantly more humiliating climb downs than Brussels has.
Speaking to Alex Dean, he's a political correspondent with The Prospect magazine in the UK about the political chaos that is unfolding in his country, months ahead of the hard deadline for the UK's exit from the European Union. Are you seeing any financial impacts in the present, capital flight, that sort of thing?
We are a bit. We're seeing the pound has suffered a huge amount of turbulence and, you know, plummeted, actually, in the wake of the referendum results. Now, normally, devaluing the currency would have some positive effects on manufacturing exports and so on that haven't actually materialised. So it seems like we've had the downsides of the falling pound without the upsides.
Right, because no one wants to invest in refurbishing their factory if they're about to lose their ability to export to Europe customs-free.
You can certainly make that sort of case. And the CBI, the Confederation of British Industry, has been sounding the alarm bells over this. Now, businesses don't really want to get involved. There are a few exceptions of business leaders who have been outspoken from the start, but by and large, of course, all business leaders want to stay out of the political fray and out of the controversy if they possibly can. But what we're seeing is more and more of them starting to speak out as the process winds on. They're worried about Brexit, but they're particularly worried about no deal. And I think this is the crucial point. Brexit is creating a huge amount of uncertainty, which is going to damage business even in itself, even before you start talking about, you know, supply chains for manufacturing, and you put up borders, you know, sometimes car parts travel backwards and forwards across between the UK and Europe 16 or 17 times before they make it into the car. So, you know, you impose borders where previously there were none, and it's going to make life very difficult indeed for businesses. And Brexit presents all sorts of challenges. But no deal is by far the most scary option. No deal where we fall out with no replacement arrangement in place could be extremely damaging for businesses. It could be extremely damaging for the economy at large, the City of London, you know, financial sector that the UK is dependent on. But it could also be very damaging indeed for individuals with, for example, life-threatening conditions, frankly. There's all sorts of worries at the moment. Hard for one to know how much it's, you know, exaggeration in the press and so on, but there's a lot of fear about stockpiling insulin and so on. Now, the government is starting to make contingency plans for no deal, but that just seems to be scaring people even more, because they're seeing the reality of, you know, the health secretary, Matt Hancock, talking about stockpiling fridges so that we can you know, store decaying isotopes and so on for the NHS. It's a worrying time. I think businesses, you know, the UK economy seems to be strong at the foundations, and businesses will cope, but I don't think they'll thrive. I think they could thrive inside the European Union.
Alex Dean, is there no procedural prospect of kind of a punt, a stay of execution from the European Union, pushing that deadline back further?
So this is the really interesting thing. The European Union absolutely would give us the right to extend Article 50. This is the legal mechanism from the Lisbon Treaty that sets a two-year countdown on the Brexit process and kind of sets it in train. We triggered Article 50. It runs out in March and we leave. They absolutely would extend that deadline, but only if it was because Britain was doing so in good faith to, for example, have a second referendum. The EU won't just go out of its way to help us out. Extending Article 50 is very difficult for the European Union because of the European parliamentary elections. If it extends Article 50, then it feels like Britain needs to participate in those, but that's very awkward given that it's going to be leaving shortly after. So a huge amount of issues around that sort of thing. If we were going to have a second referendum, the European Union has said that it wants us to stay and would be able to make the provisions to give us the time. But then you get to the question of how would we go about doing that in the UK Parliament? Because, as I said previously, there's no majority for a second referendum, but there's certainly no majority for a specific question on the ballot paper in a second referendum. The Electoral Commission would then have to sign off on the question, even if MPs could come up with it. So we're looking at a situation now where there's no majority for any one outcome. Each outcome looks incredibly unlikely. No deal Brexit looks unlikely. Theresa May's deal looks unlikely. Second referendum looks unlikely. A unilateral revoking of Article 50 and cancelling Brexit altogether by Parliament is possible. And indeed, the European Court of Justice said as much a couple of weeks ago. But that would, I think, be seen as politically toxic, to say the least, for MPs to scrub out the result of a referendum with a high turnout, you know, millions and millions of British voters told their vote would count. I think Parliament could only legitimately scrub that out with a second referendum. All these options are unlikely, but one of them is going to have to happen. And what's scary is that as time's going on, none of them are becoming more likely other than no deal. So it's a very scary situation for us, I have to say.
All right. Alex Dean, appreciate you catching up on the story. That's all the time we have for today.
Thanks very much.
Alex Dean is a political correspondent with The Prospect magazine in the UK. And again, the hard deadline under the United Kingdom's invocation of Article 50 is March 29th, 2019. This is a story we expect to be tracking well into the new year because there doesn't appear to be any resolution in immediate sight.